Live, just about 15 minutes later than planned. We got a guest out on a job site. He had a few things he needed to whack them all on before we could get them on. No big deal. We're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects today, and that is, of course, biochar. I actually haven't done a show on biochar for quite a while. That's probably a mistake, so it's good that his app came in, I think, over the Christmas break or soon after. Biochar is something that I have integrated into our homestead here just about every level. It starts making it. It ends up in the chicken coop. It ends up in the compost. It ends up on the land. And it ends up in other places like in my dog's food and even sometimes my own. So we are a truly biochar integrated homestead. But we're going to talk about taking it to another level today with our guest, Zach Farr, who's done some really impressive farm scale level work. And we're going to be talking about really restoring a lot of what we think of as traditional farming, homesteading, living off the land, call it what you want to, modern survivalism, using this technology that seems to be new, but anybody that's researched it knows it's actually thousands and thousands of years old. In fact, maybe more than 10,000 years old. It all depends on which version of ancient history you choose to subscribe to. When we look back that far. Anyway, before we get into it, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors of the day. Our sponsor of the day, number one today, is another traditional technology from South Africa. It's called Biltong. And if you've never tried Biltong, maybe this is your signal that you should. Get on over to Biltong USA. If you're an MSB member, make sure you get your discount. Try the real deal. Anton makes this amazing Biltong. He also makes these things called Drew Wars, which are basically kind of like a Biltong flavored dry sausage. He makes another sausage I like even more called Kalabanazi, which is more of a Middle Eastern sausage. Biltong sticks, that's spelled STIX. That's like all the cuttings and trimmings off the outside of the eye around that gets kind of more hard and crispy. Those are delicious. And he has a lot of cool stuff that he imports, not just from South Africa, but from around the world. This is a great product, a great partner, a great sponsor, great discount vendor, all in one. And Anton's also kind of a warrior for freedom, man. He's moved his entire operation because his local government became too much of a pain in the ass. And he comes from a place where, you know, South Africa, you can see how governments become way too much of a pain in the ass and even a danger. It seems like a lot of people that come here from places like that recognize that even more than us. So he's just a good guy to do business with all around. Next up today, a guy that we've been working with for about as long as anybody that we still work with anyway, and maybe a lot longer than a lot of people we don't work with anymore, and that is Jeff, the Berkey Guy Gleason, and his website, usaberkeyfilters.com. Check that out. We talked about this yesterday with John and Nicole. When they tell you, hey, you need to boil your water, you've been drinking water with bullshit in it you didn't want to drink for a while already. That's why all the water we drink goes through a Berkey filter. If you try it, you'll see why. Very cost effective. Just about as foolproof as anything can be. The only way you can mess it up is don't put the filters in it. I mean, that's about the only way you can mess it up. Check it out today. Again, usaberkeyfilters.com. And Jeff became a sponsor of this show the first time in 2011. It's 2026. I know when you say 2011 today and you're like a 50-something, it doesn't seem that long ago. It's a long time ago, guys, longer than we like to think about. With that, I want to welcome our special guest, Zach Farr, to the Survival Podcast, man. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jack. Appreciate your patience.
Yeah, man, no problem. I mean, we all have things we're trying to accomplish, and yours is kind of directly related to what we're talking about today anyway. Can we start out, though? Who the heck and what the heck is Zach Farr? Let's go back before you were doing all the stuff you're doing now, like you're spacing out with school or something, trying to figure out what to do with your life. What was your, like, professional background, and how did you end up in this space?
Sure. I'm a third-generation citrus farmer in Central Florida. So I was born and raised. I grew up in an orange grove, you know, since I was a baby. My first word was tractor. So, you know, grew up on the farm, and I worked in the groves my whole life, did watermelons, cattle, very privileged to live in a rural community in the heart of the Sunshine State. And I ended up pivoting to, I wanted to get into business. So I went to Florida State University, and citrus was always like a backdoor second option in case, you know, the business side of things fell through. And after Florida State, I went to Miami. I was actually in sales down in downtown Miami for a few years. And in 2019, my boss asked if I was happy. I said no. I gave him a 30, 60, 90 day plan on how I could stay. And he's like, as a business, we should plan on you leaving today. And you know, we want to wish you the best. So I was actually on my mom's birthday in December of 2019. But the first person I called was my grandpa saying, hey, I'm out of a job. He's like, we're doing cows on Monday. So, you know, I went from downtown Miami to castrating 45 bulls in a matter of 72 hours. And then in 2020 is when I really tried to, you know, I was living back at home. At that time, the citrus industry collapsed 95% in production. So, you know, the backbone of the Florida economy suddenly took a hit, a pretty bad hit. And I've always wanted to find some economic opportunities for this rural disadvantaged community. And that's kind of like what got me into this opportunity, because where some people see problems, meaning, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres of dead citrus, you know, the economy's collapsing and the communities that were built upon this industry, I wanted to find some, I see opportunity, and that's what kind of got us to where we're at today.
Yeah, I'm just going to say real quick for people tuning in. Yes, Jack put the wrong effing title on the stream. I'll fix it later. I can't really fix it right now. It is yesterday's title. Today was a crammed in day for both me and my guest. Anyway, I like the statement there that you saw the problem as an opportunity. I've been saying that forever. The big difference between entrepreneur-minded people and everybody else in the world is most people see a problem and say, somebody should do something about that because it's a problem and I don't like it, so somebody should fix it for me. Entrepreneurs call those people potential customers, right? And so when we see a problem, we say, if I can solve that problem, or at least mitigate that problem, then I have potential customers that would pay me money for that solution, and therefore it's an opportunity. And I think that is a fundamental switch. And I always say not everybody can be an entrepreneur, but everybody can make the mental switch if they want to. And that might be the most fundamental thing that you can do toward changing your mindset of starting to see it's a problem. That means there's an opportunity. And I don't know why we don't teach. Oh, I actually do know why we don't teach that. Because if we taught that, there'd be a whole lot of kids sitting in that school going, I see a shitload of problems right here.
Why am I here?
To start with, right?
That's a good perspective. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So let's start off with that. Your solution here involves biochar. So we can start off with, it's almost as bad as permaculture. Everybody that makes biochar, you ask them what biochar is, they give you a slightly different explanation of it. Maybe not as varied as permaculture is a broad umbrella, but how would you explain biochar to somebody that just doesn't know what that means? To them, it could be Kingsford briquettes, which that ain't going to make it happen.
So, yeah, the story on how we got into biochar, I think, kind of paints that picture, because I had no idea what it was in 2022. And in 2022, you know, in one of your podcasts about entrepreneurship, you mentioned, like, in order to start, you got to start. So what we started with was industrial hemp for textiles. And industrial hemp is an exceptional phytoremediating plant. And what happened was, if they can see my screen here, this is from 2022. Those plants grew 12 feet tall in 60 days. And we realized that they only grew well where they were on old citrus burn piles. Mm. So the ash and the carbon from the burned citrus trees that went into the soil was the only way that we could grow anything on Central Florida's sandy ridge soil. So that's, you know, we started researching carbon and soil because we couldn't grow any other crops to replace citrus until we fixed the soil in Central Florida. It's 90% sand. I like to call it dead dirt. Scientists don't like the D word, but it's really dead, like unliving soil. And so then we got into this word called biochar. And I'm sure in some of your podcasts, you mentioned Terra Preta and how it started in the Amazon basin. And not all biochar is the same. You can get it. There's a lot of waste streams and sawmills, as well as like coal mining mills, that have this end product that has a lot of ash in it, where we have acquired the mobile technology that can convert up to 20 tons of wood per hour into, you know, 2 to 3 tons of biochar. And in order to create biochar, you basically have to heat up wood with low limits of oxygen, which allow the carbon to stay stored into a material just like charcoal. However, if you're using it for soil or water purposes, they deem the word biochar. If you're using it to cook your steak, it's charcoal.
Yeah. I mean, I put it this way. All biochar is charcoal, but not all charcoal is biochar. It's really a matter of purity. You can have it not quite be biochar because it wasn't quite taken far enough in the process, or it cannot be biochar because it's good charcoal, but it's been blended with binders and stuff like briquettes. So people will ask me sometimes, can I use Kingsford lump charcoal or whatever? And my answer to that is probably, but that will be the most expensive biochar you ever bought. When you crush up a bag of Kingsford lump charcoal into the size you use it as biochar, I mean, a couple handfuls. And it's much easier to make it yourself. There's a variety of ways to do that. We'll probably talk about it someday, along with commercial ways. Sure. But can we start off with, like, well, why is biochar particular? Well, actually, I want to back up a second. What you described with the old burn piles and the plants growing is literally the theory by which we assume that the Amazonian people making Terra Preta did the same thing. They had these midden farms and stuff, and they had, you know, they burned shit until the pit was full, and then they moved. That's a traditional, like, initial settlement. When you fuck something up bad enough that you don't want to live there anymore, you just move over and let it grow. And they observed this same phenomena and then turned it into a process. And I think that's pretty much the story you just told, the same type of thing. The observe and interact, one of the 12 primary principles of permaculture from David Holmgren. That's all we're doing here. We looked at something, we saw a result, and then taking it scientifically, let's try to replicate that. If it happens again, it's probably true. If it happens three times, well, we can kind of put the nail down and say this is the variable making the difference.
We were very blessed. At the same time we found this out and we started looking into biochar, the property appraiser, Sam, from Highlands County, Central Florida, we sat down with him, and he showed us, they did aerial footages from 2011 to 2017, where they burned the citrus groves, and they had aerial footages of where you can see the burn piles. And then 6 years later, they did aerial footages of where the citrus trees were growing, and the diameter of the base of the tree outside of the burn piles was 8 inches, and where the trees were planted in the burn piles was 12 inches. And that was unsolicited data that we needed to show the value in it. And then, you know, if you type in biochar online, the white papers are endless.
And
the abundance of wood that we have in Central Florida that's being burned. I just saw this opportunity and wanted to dive in on it.
Yeah, I think the scientific community and the research has been corrected to where, when I first really started talking about this about 5-6 years ago heavily, I had to always correct the initial shit done like in 08, 09, in that time frame, because those studies were clearly designed to fail out of the gate. There were people with an agenda against this, and I feel that the results are such that the people that tried to destroy it had to give up, and other people took on the research. I don't think they changed their ways. I think they just got out of the way and let real research be done. And it's pretty conclusive. And with that in mind, can you talk about why it's particularly relevant right now to be discussing biochar and biochar technology when it comes to things like soil health, water quality, land stewardship? I think water quality is one people totally miss. And I don't necessarily mean hanging a bag of biochar in a creek. There's a huge impact on biochar on the land as to water systems.
I got a sock in the back of my truck, you know, of it in the biochar, and we're working on some projects. We coined my scientist Joseph Nielsen, very privileged to have this guy on my team. He coined the phrase circular nutrient management. So in most rural communities, like Pinellas has 50,000 tons of wood waste a year that they don't know what to do with. So that's Pinellas, St. Pete, right?
Yeah.
Every community has wood. Imagine if that community, we go into it with a machine, we can carbonize the wood on site, deploy it in a local water body, and once it becomes saturated, because it'll accept and capture any phosphorus or nitrogen that flows through it. So then it sucks up all these nutrients that are oversaturated in our water bodies, and you take it out, and then you have fertilizer that you can provide back to the soil where it can be stored for thousands of years. So circular nutrient management is something that we're trying to articulate, and education, as you understand, is a massive piece in this thing. And that's something that every community can replicate because of the challenges of wood waste. Most landfills are overfilled. You know, we're losing 120 acres of ag land a day in Florida. Yeah. I'm on a land clearing job right now. It's 30 acres, and I'm a Florida boy. I've read A Land Remembered 10 times. I don't know if you've ever read that book.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have? Yeah. So yeah. I you know, like, I don't like that we're taking, you know, this state's oaks and burning it, but if we can capture as much as we can and put it back into our soils, because one of the main reasons they left in the ancient civilizations was because they depleted the soils, and that's
correct.
One of the main, like, theories as to why, you know, a lot of these civilizations left. And imagine, you know, in America, we're losing like 6 inches of topsoil a year. So, yeah. You know, it's going to become a national emergency at some point, unless, you know, guys like us talk about it and let everybody know what it can do.
Yeah, I think Mark Shepard famously said many times, every civilization built on annual agriculture collapsed. And my only pushback on that is pretty much every civilization that ever existed collapsed. But pretty much every civilization that ever existed because of annual agriculture. So
right.
I'm not sure who wins that circular logic fight, but there's definitely something to it. And you just actually gave me a flashback to an old Jeff Lawton lecture. One of the coolest things I ever saw him do, explaining how we can usually, like, he called it a little flick to restart an entire system. He drew out this, like, went to the nth degree of how to capture everything you can on runoff on this property with swales and deposition traps and all that. He gets to the end, and he's like, well, we got one little spot right here by the border. And once it goes off our land, we can't do anything about it. So we'll put one little pond in here and plant some reeds. And then we'll cut those reeds several times a season, take them up to the top of the system and mulch with them. And all the nutrient that they've caught before that water ebbs out of the property gets flicked back up to the top of the property. You can do that about 1,000 times better with biochar socks.
Yes. Yeah. It's the challenge. Now that I'm like, I've been in this for a year, like operating is, you know, it's like what you said, right? You got to start. And we started and I put everything on the line for this. And what I've learned very quickly is the reason why it's not like as popular. One of the reasons is it's very difficult to make, you know, it's extensive CapEx, OpEx, safety, and then quality too. You know, if you feed the machine too much, you get more ash than you do carbon. And it's like, there's so many like learning curves that we are experiencing, and we're privileged to have these learning curves because we're open to a rising tide raises all ships, especially in like an industry as, with as much upside as this one does.
Yeah. I think one of the things people have to get their head around from the economics of it is the duration of the benefit.
Yeah.
Right. If you compare it to a sack of NPK, well, the financials don't work, but if you realize that that NPK won't make it one season.
Right.
It doesn't make it one season. Like, it may make your season, but it's not there at the end of the season. It is gone. What is there is usually inert and locked up. Like, in my research, I've learned that, like, the average farm field in America that's dumping phosphorus on their field every single year has 42 years worth of phosphorus sitting there the plants can't get to. So when we start turning on biology and we start creating housing for our biology with biochar and other techniques, we're unlocking, you know, centuries of benefit or millennia of benefit. So the cost, if you just apportion it over 10 years, let alone 100, because most of us will be dead by then. If you're alive at 101, you're 1 year old right now, you know. So it's hard for people to think in that multi-generation. We should be, but we're just not. We're recovering addicts, and you got to take it one step at a time. In like a decade, you could probably see yourself still working this land in 10 years. And if you're still benefiting from this 10 years from now, you're going to look at the cost of that improvement differently than a short-term solution like fertilizer, even if it's organic, or a cover crop even, because it's still a short-term solution. Where if I'm putting a road in, a fence, a pond, something that on my balance sheet I'm going to depreciate over 30 years or 40 years or something like that, I expect to pay more today because I'm buying it across decades, not across quarters. And I think that's something that it's hard for people to get their head around. And until we do, it's going to make the startup more difficult. And I think the other thing is farmers finance everything. So if they can't finance it, then that also is an impediment, even if they want to do it, even if they're willing to budget it.
Have you heard of the NRCS Soil Amendment Code 336 by the USDA?
No, I know who NRCS is, but I don't know about that amendment.
Yeah, it was a big deal last year, and then actually, or 2 years ago, and last year we called it like Black Friday when they pulled the funding, which was why a lot of the biochar developers ended up, you know, collapsing. And in order for this to make dollars and cents for farmers short term, because you're right, like farmers finance everything.
Yeah.
They're very, respectfully, they're in their ways. You know, they like their ways. They stick with their ways. And, you know, it's a challenging industry, and there's a lot of snake oil that they get pitched all the time.
Yeah.
But in order for this to work, you know, we have great relationships with some of our political leaders in the state, as well as in DC, Washington, D.C., but we're trying to get some cost share, you know. Like on paper in Florida, it says that farmers can get reimbursed $1,700 per acre applying 4 yards of biochar. That's great on paper.
Yeah, that works.
We had 17 people apply last year, and none of them heard feedback. And we had a you know, some support as well. So the United States Biochar Initiative, we're working with them. They're exceptional. If anybody wants to know more about biochar, they're a great nonprofit, and we're working with them to do a regional USDA NRCS proposal for 2027 in Florida, where hopefully we can support, you know, all the markets in the region. You know, tomatoes, blueberries, watermelon, cattle, strawberries, all the soils are nutrient locked or deprived, and that's our goal next year, is to have some support from, you know, Uncle Sam to show the proof in the pudding.
Can you talk a little bit about how converting wood waste into biochar can help communities become more self-reliant instead of being dependent on outside systems? Because part of what we're hitting on right now, we're trying to do something for self-sufficiency, and it's outside sources that are in some ways the impediment.
Right.
Because they're sources of funding. I mean, anybody that thinks the farmers got it easy is a retard. I'm sorry. There's no other word to describe this. I'm Gen X. I'll never give up that word. You've never grown a turnip if you think a farmer has it easy. And right. It's always riding the edge of bankruptcy, right? It's like McDonald's. It's not about the burger. It's about the real estate, and the farming is how the real estate remains in possession of the farmer. So one screw up can cost them literally the farm, right? So I understand the resistance of putting capital in that could either be retained for emergency or spent on something with immediate return. But on the other hand, if we do it right over time, you sever that system of dependency that's in the way in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, there's a lot of things I wanted to touch up on with that. One of our partners with Life Soils, they have an exceptional living soil amendment that's like compost, but like on steroids. Their guy, Brian, told me that the farmer that survives is the one that invests into the soil, you know? And so that, I just thought that was a cool thing, what you said about the farmer. But from a community perspective, you can just picture in your head, imagine you have 200,000 tons of wood from a hurricane, a land clearing development, but that is pure energy. It's mm-hmm. biomass, it's living. And you have a machine that can convert that 200,000 tons into 20,000 tons of organic stable carbon. That machine could power literally half of the community, or, you know, the syngas can power something in that community that uses a lot of power, the data centers that are coming in. And then most data centers, most steel manufacturers, most water filtration companies, they use carbon. So they have to import it from other places. Like this water filtration company in Florida, they're getting it from Oregon. The steel manufacturer in town, they're getting it from Pennsylvania. So rather than outsourcing to other places in the United States, you can keep all that money in the community. And we had at one point 10 full-time employees and with one machine. So if we get three machines, suddenly we're at 30 employees, not including HR, insurance, everything yeah. around the entire commodity. And that's so, you know, you got local, you got water bodies, you got retention ponds that are oversaturated. You have all these challenges that this material can create or I guess capture and make it, recycle it to make it better again for that
yeah.
community.
Yeah. And I think we kind of glossed over this when we were talking about the water issue. So I want to back up to that for a second. There is that direct method, which is we can literally take polluted water, depollute it, and turn the pollution into fertilizer in the biochar. And there are things that biochar can take up that you don't really want in your plants, but the plants aren't going to get it because you put it in the biochar, because it's an energetic process to get it off the biochar, and the plant's not going to put the energy into what it doesn't want. So that's a pretty good explanation there. But there's like two jobs a fire chief has. One is put the fire out when the fire starts. That's kind of what we just talked about. But the other job is let's try to have shit not burn down in the first place. So by incorporating biochar in the soil, we actually hold a lot of runoff in the soil. We use less conventional practices, more organic practices, less till, no-till, cover cropping, etc. And we can fix what's already in the water. At the same time, we can prevent more garbage from going into the water. And I don't know anything else that does that. And I can give people 10 different ways to do it, because there's things like just direct application. We can actually put deposition traps that are biochar charged. We can do the direct reapplication like you talked about. I mean, there's dozens of ways to come at improving water quality using something that's basically transformed waste. And again, I'm back to, if something else does that, somebody tell me what it is, because we'll add it. But I don't know anything that does that.
You know, the entrepreneurial spirit, I don't know where it came from. My dad is a farmer. He's a very respected, hardworking farmer. My mom, she was a school teacher, was committed for years and, just retired. And they're like, are you sure this is working? Like, you know, like what's the backup plan? And nobody has told me, nobody's said, hey, we don't like your biochar in our process. Nobody, no water, new steel. And no municipality has turned us down. Nothing has said this doesn't work. And I'm looking for that. Or, hey, this is better. You know, yeah. like activated carbon might be the thing for water filtration now, or for petroleum air intake and those types of systems.
Yeah.
But when we've incorporated our biochar into those systems, it's worked just as well. And it's a lot cheaper because it's local.
And you need it twice as much. It still costs less. So,
right.
And you get a great product as a byproduct. Yeah.
Yeah, I love what you said about the what it does and does not eat, right? The example I like to say is like fertilizer is food. But if you put food outside, what happens in a day? It's gone. But if you put food in the refrigerator, it's stored. And that's what biochar is. Biochar is a refrigerator. Now imagine you're a microbe and you're at your friend's house and you say, hey, you can have anything in my refrigerator. You got, you know, milk, and then you got stale milk. You're not going to drink the stale milk. You're going to drink the good milk. And that's the cation exchange capacity of what allows the plant to eat on what it wants to eat versus, you know, the bad stuff, which it could pull out of the water. You know, you got PFAS, you got alum, you got a lot of these things that it could capture. And you just want to be careful with overstating what it can or cannot do, because not all biochar is created the same.
Yeah, definitely. What are your biggest challenges? Maybe some hard lessons you learned while developing a mobile processing facility.
The law of the minimum. If you try to cut costs and be cheap, or just try to cut costs, you're going to spend the most amount of money. I'd like to go to our first demonstration of our Tiger Cat, where I had a 10-ton excavator and we tried to put it on bricks to look inside of the machine. And rather than it working, we accidentally dropped the excavator onto the Tiger Cat in front of everybody. So then I had to get a 25-ton excavator. So, like, you know, cutting costs was something we learned at the beginning. This is an expensive operation and we gotta accept that. And then employees, the first month I had the entire wrestling team on the job site thinking, you know, these are young guys. They can figure it out. And I said, when one water tank's empty, swap the tanks, swap one hose to the next hose. You're done. And I'm in my truck on a call like this. And I look at the machine and it just starts spitting hot white coal out of the machine because they didn't swap the water tanks, which caused my conveyor to catch on fire, which caused the coal to fall underneath the machine to catch the hydraulics on fire. And we were like this close from having a total loss. So, you know, the operation has by far been my biggest challenge, is just learning how to turn wood into biochar with all these pieces of equipment. And I think that's the biggest one. That's why I said, you know, the reason why it's not everywhere is just because it's expensive and it's very hard. And a lot of the money doesn't show up right away because the big buyers, they want to see consistency, sustainability, reliability, and you have to prove that.
Yeah. How can landowners, farmers, small communities start thinking about using local wood waste instead of treating it as a liability?
So that's we're very fortunate to have partnered with a local municipality in Central Florida that the city of Minneapolis created a biochar department. And there's some other municipalities that are trying to do that as well. So we've partnered with one to teach them everything that we have learned, and bringing a small, anybody that wants to get into biochar, I strongly recommend like having a big, beautiful, you know, a big, hairy, audacious goal, a 25-year crazy dream, and then backtrack it to how do we start as safe and as feasible as possible? How do I make 1 pound of biochar? Okay. We started with we called it our cracker kiln. You know, it was a 50-gallon drum. We put citrus in it, and then we went to a $1 million Tiger Cat. We should have started with that. Move to a $150,000 air burner, you know, make 500 pounds an hour, and then went to the Tiger Cat. But we went
straight, you know,
go big or go home. So, that's what I would, there's a biochar on site. They're a nonprofit that does webinars, every month that teaches how communities can get behind, you know, doing this in a cost effective, economical way.
And what did you say the machine you're using is called? Tiger Cat?
Yes, sir. So Tiger Cat 6040 Carbonizer. We have serial number 11.
Okay. I'm pulling that up so I can look at it while we're talking. Can we talk more about, like, what role can biochar realistically play in restoring degraded soils specifically? Because I do think sometimes it comes off to people like it's, you know, snake oil or something. And we have the data to prove the claims now, but I think maybe the claims are not understood, or maybe even being somewhat oversold by zealots who don't really know. Like, they heard about it and they, I read, and then they give this litany of shit and none of it's based on some of it's right, but none of it's based in reality.
My, what Joe would tell me is, not all biochar is the same, right? You gotta pick your, and then biochar is a lot like salt on a steak. If you put a lot of salt on the steak, it takes all the flavor. If you add a little bit of salt, it enhances the flavor. It's not a solution in itself, but it is a part of a solution. So most of the soil blending that we're doing is 5 to 20% depending on the soil structure. So we definitely recommend soil samples at the beginning to determine that. And, you know, we have a project with University of Florida, and, you know, we're seeing a 30% reduction in fertilizer inputs. And we're not there yet in the science of our own personal test, but I think Kiss the Ground says that if you can increase the organic matter in soil 1%, it saves 15,000 to 23,000 gallons of water per water application. There's a golf course in California that invested $300,000 in biochar. They saved $6 million in water. So it holds six times its weight in water. Like
And I got kind of a, it's not scientific. I'm trying to look for, what's the other word? Anecdotal evidence of this. A little bit scientific, but a couple of years ago when I first started using this in my potting soil.
That's awesome.
I was running about 10% charged up biochar in my potting soil mix, which was mostly just some sharp sand in my compost. And a little bit of perlite so you can tell everything got mixed, because that way you can see that it got mixed. And I took some really good potting soil, Fox Farm, the farm forest one. It's one. I always tell people, if you're going to buy something and do it, just buy it for starting plants, use that. It's good. And they both did pretty good. The biochar and bioreactor compost kind of exploded the growth away. But I took a small section of both. And I stopped watering them under plant lights. So usually a day, you forget to water for a day, your plants are sick. You forget 2 days, you're dead. And the ones that didn't have biochar were dead as a doornail in 48 hours. The ones with biochar looked really sick at 7 days, but they would have come back. It took 9 days to kill them with no water and a tiny little pot plant, right? And that is, to me, just on water, like, water was the variable there. How dry, how fast. And that absorbency of the charcoal just held on to the water longer. And we have lots of stuff. Like, I had the guys from American Biochar on, and they have a liquid product. And all they did was dump it on one side of a park and not the other. And the difference after 3 years was unbelievable. So that water retention, and then it also helps then, because of the water retention, drive the roots deeper. So it absolutely does that.
There's actually for the farmers that are trying it out, it's, if you add to, so my first, I love you talk about your antidote. Like, when my first bag of biochar I bought was from Wakefield Biochar. They're out of Georgia, and they're one of the leaders in the space. I bought a 1.5 cubic yard bag. And when I, like, back in the day when I built Legos, I didn't read the directions. I just put stuff together, right? Well, sometimes you should read the directions, because I just put the 1.5 cubic yard bag in 1.5 cubic feet, and I put sunflower seeds in it.
Okay.
And then I read the directions, like, this can cover 10,000 square feet, you know? So there's a, company in Florida that, the largest regenerative citrus growers now in the state, last year they did 2 pounds per acre of liquid biochar, and it locked up the entire grove. It's a powerful product. It's a lot like salt. If they would have done 1 pound per acre, perhaps it would have actually supported it. We're working with them to help them out this year, because they want to do it again, though, which is Some would just call it after that. So there it's you just got to be start small and then go higher, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk more also about water filtration. Most water filtration is handled by great big giant plants and things like that. And that means that a lot of water carries a lot of waste a long distance and does a lot of things before it is fixed. And it usually isn't exactly the greatest quality when it comes out the other end. And so that's a centralized model. And one thing I love about biochar is you could centralize components of it, but overall it's a distributed model. That's what it is. You use the waste that makes good biochar as close to where the waste was made as the biochar is going to go as you can. That's a distributed model. So how does that affect water quality when we start looking at it that way?
So that's water quality was our first like push to get into biochar. There's a company in Florida and they create constructed wetlands for water filtration. So it's a nature-based solution at scale. And in North Florida, they got an 11-acre wetland and it's recharging North Florida's aquifer. And they use 40,000 cubic yards of their media that has, you know, a 30% blend of biochar in it. Mm-hmm. And it filters, it can filter 11 million gallons of water a day and pull out 99.9% of the phosphorus that passes through it. And then it all goes back down into North Florida's aquifer where, you know, Jacksonville and yeah. The rest of those saturated areas are.
Huh. Jacksonville was my backyard when I was a kid. I grew up until I was 14, I lived in Jacksonville.
904.
A very familiar with the area.
Yeah.
How does keeping working land productive also help protect rural communities from development pressure? Because especially in Florida, like if there's a piece of land, somebody wants to put a house or a condo or an apartment complex on it. Like, and so if you're a farmer and you're barely getting by and a developer walks in and goes, I'll pay off all your debt and I'll hand you an additional check for $5.5 million. And you can go buy a condo down in Miami and say, fuck this for the rest of your life. There's a big temptation to say, no, okay, right? So you got that kind of an asset, but it's making you a cash flow that you could make as a manager at Walmart, right? There's a point where you say, like, I always say, like, the show's not for sale, but somebody walked in here with $50 million like they did with Joe Rogan, I'd probably do that, right? Everybody has a price. So how do we at least push that price up so this happens less?
Yeah, that's a great, it's going to require collaboration and multiple revenue streams per acre. My grandpa said it best. Why would I grow something when I can, and work to grow something when I could sell my land for $25,000 an acre, put it into a CD and make $1,250 a year doing nothing? So that's that to me, that's the number, like $1,500 an acre and rev profit, depending on that characteristic or that demographic. My father earlier this week sold his first grove ever. He's never sold a grove, and I could tell it's weighing on him. I mean, he probably, it's in the middle of nowhere, you know, in a little community, Central Florida, Berea. And it's something that everybody's feeling. The encroachment of the development is substantial. It's overwhelming. I get calls every day. Hey, like, you know, Mr. Farr, you know, they're trying to reach out to my father or my grandpa or my uncle or something. And it will require a collaborative effort from a lot of different, like the Florida Wildlife Corridor. They are working on some initiatives for panther crossings and water and things and soil health. If you have land and as long as you just don't develop it, you can get between $50 and $200 per acre. So I'm working with them on that nature. And then carbon credits. That is another thing that we are pretty far along with, and it's not easy to, it's certainly, it's a whole nother commodity and industry. So that, and then growing something, you know, we had freezes this past week, right? We had 4 days in the low 20s. That's like a freeze that hasn't happened in Florida in decades. And like the strawberry guys have gotten popped in Plant City, and the citrus growers, they're all taking a hit. And this could be near the end of the citrus industry. So you gotta, I don't know the right answer, but it starts with, how do I find as many, you can do U picks, right? Or citrus under protection, where, you know, the CapEx is strong, but you're making five figures an acre growing quality citrus. You gotta be innovative, and you gotta cut costs. Yeah. And you might have to spend a little bit more on CapEx, but long term, it's a, you know, if you put citrus in a citrus under protection greenhouse, you reduce there's no more greening disease flying around, and you make a higher quality fruit. So there's ways that they're trying, but it's going to require a lot more effort.
One of the things I think that we've lost, even in like the entrepreneurial subclass we would call farmers today, especially farmers that are family farmers, that their lineage goes back a century or more now. You think, oh, wow, that's great. And some aspects are. But the other side of it is, because the kids didn't build it, and the kids' kids didn't build it, and the kids' kids' kids didn't build it, one of the things that gets lost in that space versus more typical entrepreneurs and wealthy people is the idea of, but I don't ever want to sell the asset. Right. I want cash flow from the asset, but I want to retain the asset because the asset is where the real wealth is. And the asset, when properly leveraged, if it's an appreciating asset, is also cash-free tax flow. Mm-hmm. Right. And real estate is the number one way that that's been done for 5,000 years. And today they don't think that way. So what this offers is another tool in the toolkit to retain ownership and control of the asset while generating cash flow. And that's just, we live in a world today where people hear returns and it's based on tech industry and stuff like that. Like, that's not the kind of returns you get from what you would call more conservative forms of wealth. But the long-term returns are exceptional because that asset will always go up in value because, let's be honest, the form of money that we use is going to always go down in value. And even if they ever fix that, it's only a matter of a generation or two before it goes back to being a depreciating asset form of money. So if you can get farmers thinking more about, like, it is very important that the family retain the asset. But then the next question is, but how do I do that? Because I'm 66, my kids don't want nothing to do with it. And that condo down in Fort Lauderdale, I got 10, 15 years of my life left to live, looking pretty good right now. And the more ways we can actually monetize that asset, so he can hire some people and go buy the freaking thing anyway.
Yeah.
And that's it. So what is it that you want, and how do we get you that without giving up the asset, if that makes sense?
Yeah, my big, hairy, audacious goal is that we can prove this biochar makes sense and have the revenues to then lease property to grow a crop for a commodity. It's really challenging in Central Florida because a famous citrus grower in the Smoke family said that the only thing you can grow in Central Florida is citrus and sand spruce. Like, that's all that'll grow in this soil. You know, it's 90% sand. So if we can lease, the good news is that if you clear your dead citrus trees, which comes at a cost, but if you clear the groves to remove any of the contaminated wood, you get your property exemption, where basically you're paying, you know, double digits a year in property taxes for 10 years. So you don't get pressured by property taxes. You're not necessarily losing money because they're trying to find alternative feedstocks that can be more, can push back against the greening disease. And citrus farming, it was literally growing money on trees. You know, you work hard during the winter months, but you're making $2,000 an acre profit, you know, compared to blueberries or peanuts, where you're making $400 an acre. Right? Yeah. It could only grow in this sandy soil. So there hasn't been an alternative crop. What you said about innovation, there are some innovators in agriculture in Florida. The Florida Bamboo Growers Association, they've been trying to grow bamboo for 6 years. Bamboo in China is a $29 billion industry. Mm-hmm. In Florida, we have 1,200 acres of bamboo, but we don't know where the end markets are yet. They're just not proven. So what they did was they partnered with developers or investors, not developers, investors, you know, from all over the world that would buy the land to grow the crop. And if the crop isn't successful in 10 years, at least they got an asset.
Yeah.
So that's one opportunity.
That's interesting. I think part of that problem would be bamboo innately, other than maybe little plant sticks or something, is a product that needs to be value added. And so China has all this industry that turns bamboo into shit like flooring and cutting boards. And it doesn't make any sense to grow it here and send it to China. So we have to develop the value add of the production to make that crop viable in the United States, or figure out something else to do with it. Like, I'm just going to say it grows back and it makes really good biochar. I'm just going to say that because it does. It makes great biochar. Grown in sand, though, I bet you it'd be some very sharp biochar, lots of silica in it.
Bamboo biochar might be the best form of water filtration biochar.
Really?
If you, you know, but how do you make it? What type of technology? In my air current incinerator, you know, it's a carbonizer. You know, it's so hollow that we haven't tried it yet, but we, in our cracker kiln, it didn't do well.
Yeah.
So you got to have a stationary machine that's like a kiln that can push it through. And we know it in study, it's the closest thing to activated carbon, without it being, you know, going through an activated carbon process.
It needs to be crushed or processed in some way before it gets carbonized. Simply from one thing is the chambers in it can explode while it's being heated, because if it expands the air faster than the structural integrity gives out, you get little bombs. We did turn a bunch of it we had laying around from some old plant stakes and shit like that. And what we did is we just drove over it with a truck a bunch of times before, and I put it in a barrel kiln. Huh. Just an open, like where you cut the saddle side out of it. And so it's long and lays on its side. A 55-gallon drum, cut out an 18-inch strip with an angle grinder, and that was it. And we threw bamboo in there with other things. But it worked really well. But I think it was because we just basically destroyed it before it went in. So, but, you know, I guess chipper shredder. I've never put bamboo in a chipper shredder. It's harder than people think, so it may not work really well. It's something that chops it up before it gets carbonized, I think, is the key. But that said, your machine may not, like, it's designed to do a thing, and bamboo burns really freaking hot. I mean, that barrel got, it always gets red, but it got, I was waiting to see it do the, nope. You know, you throw a beer can in a campfire, yeah, and all of a sudden it just goes, and I was like, is this good? And it didn't, but I think if we would have kept adding material, it might have.
that's why it's got a lot of pores. It's very, so yeah. We've been using citrus. So this is our char, right? It's about a gram. And if I was to get tweezers and pull it back like an onion, it would cover the size of a tennis court. So it's got about 300 meters of surface area per gram of it.
And when you say that citrus, do you mean that is citrus as in, like peel waste, or is that prunings, or is it everything? What is it actually made out of?
So it's this is pure citrus biochar. We were going to inactive citrus groves in Central Florida and clearing the land. So we were making revenue from the land clearing, and then we're making revenue from the biochar sales and the carbon credit narrative too. Like, you know, the end buyers really liked the story. However, we learned soon after that the citrus trees, when you plant them, they had that metal stake that keeps them supported.
Yeah.
And so they all embedded the stake.
I didn't know where that was going. Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, we got flaming hot metal stakes popping off my augers, and, you know, 200 per acre, 200 trees per acre. And then they get caught in the augers, and then the sand of the roots were glassifying the outer walls. So that's where we had to pivot out of the citrus groves. And we might go back in. We're working with the Florida Department of Ag for some cost share for the farmers. Because if we can, one of Florida's biggest problems, challenges, is water and leaching. And we all know that. That's why Lake Okeechobee is the most contaminated lake in the United States, is because everything from Orlando down is flowing into Lake Okeechobee. So if we can put the char in the ground on the soil where we're going to be fertilizing, like what you said, most of those fertilizers we're preventing it from happening before it actually does. So it's just a conversation and a needle that needs to be moved up, you know, the Tallahassee chain of command.
Yeah. And that's where you're at. You're like mid-state, right?
Yes, sir. Central Florida.
Okay. Cause one of the things I keep thinking of as we're talking, and this is not business, you know, business has to work with what it has, where it is, right? But one of the other like industries I see there that seems to have massive potential is sugarcane. Because sugarcane bagasse makes really good biochar too. And this is a product that's the one good thing I can say for it is it's perennial. They cut it and it grows back. And all of that, after it's squeezed out for sugar, something has to be done with that material. And that seems like it's also a very, like, sometimes centralized is kind of good. Like if you had a biochar kiln facility where the sugar cane was being squeezed out, it can go right from where it's squeezed out into the kiln. It really should be dried first and all, but that could probably be dealt with, right? Like there's ways that like the heat from the last batch is drying out the next batch, like some way that could, or even if it is dried out for, you know, a month before it goes in the kiln, like that seems like a huge opportunity. And straight back to the sugarcane plantations to hold the fertilizer so they fertilize less and it stops, to be blunt, because I'm a fisherman and I travel to South Florida all the time, fucking up my fishing with red tides and killing giant snooks and tarpons and groupers and freaking whale sharks washing up on Sanibel Island. I prefer that didn't happen.
Right. Yeah, me neither. I fish on a little Gasparilla, Boca Grande all the time. The Everglades, and you can... When it starts this year, it's going to be terrible. You know, it's going to start raining, and it's going to, you know, it's going to get, and that's toxic. You know, those blue green algae.
Bad.
You know, it's bad for your respiratory system and all that stuff. And I know that the sugarcane companies down there are doing biochar now.
Yeah.
They have their own processes. 51% of biochar developers create their own technology in this space. So a lot of it's pretty, seclusive and internalized.
Yeah.
But it's something that they're doing it. I wish they would do more of it. I mean, if you drive to Miami, you can see the plumes, and I think we've lost 4 to 6 feet of topsoil and like Belgrade and Clewiston and all those areas, and it's just going down to the Everglades and Fort Lauderdale. We have a project with Residents for Resilience. They're another nonprofit. And the lady who started that organization, she got sick paddleboarding in the canals of Fort Lauderdale. And, we just need the municipality support to kind of encourage these nature-based solutions.
It's a three-way game of grab ass down there. You've got the homeowners throwing true green Camelon shit all over their freaking houses right on the canals.
Yep.
It's Florida. You don't need that. Plant St. Augustine grass and quit fucking around and you're good, right? But no, they got homeowners associations and everybody's getting spray. And then you got the sugarcane people and the two of them are pointing fingers at each other. But it's like the Spider-Man with three, because you got the Corps of Engineers. And when you go up the river to Lake Okeechobee from either side, the last 10 miles on both sides are perfectly straight concrete lined troughs. So that lake that used to be like the giant lungs of the Everglades that had to go through that 10, like there was no way to get to Okeechobee on a boat. It was like coming through the skank of the swamp, right?
Yeah.
It was a filter. So the state and the Corps of Engineers and the federal government took away the filter. The sugarcane people throw fertilizer out the ass on it and make everything flat and square so everything runs off. And then the homeowners do the same thing and bring the Camelon companies in, and all three of them point at each other. And you actually have to address that problem from all three angles. I know a product that would fix it. I just, could we make enough of it would be the question. But I mean, like, all three of those things can be addressed with biochar directly and indirectly.
It's only a problem. Like, Florida is a show me state. You gotta pay your way to play in the Sunshine State. You gotta, you know, if I can get a meeting with FDEP tomorrow, but I need to have my dollars invested into a project, which we don't have yet.
Yeah.
To make this happen. And the other thing is, like, it's not a problem unless you make it a problem, or unless it is a big ass freaking problem. Like,
yeah.
And it's probably going to get worse, unfortunately, before it gets better. But this is the best way to do it, though, because the problem with the wood waste is pretty abundant and it's costly to municipalities. You know,
yeah.
If your
yeah.
landfill's filled, you have to pay to move it somewhere else.
Stop taking this over there and paying to do it, and pay to change it where it is and put it back where it came from.
Yes.
Like, this is one of those things that, like, it's obvious to everybody but a bureaucrat.
Yep. Well,
especially when the bureaucrat's brother-in-law works for the company that transports the material to the landfill, and his sister-in-law's, uncle runs the landfill. Mm-hmm. And it gets really hard to explain things when you're dealing with that.
Everybody's family up there, you know.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I spoke in front of a lot of the House representatives. I had the privilege, and they were very receptive to the presentation with industrial hemp in March of last year, where I'm like, we got 200,000 acres in Central Florida that is fallow. We got 50,000 jobs in this region that are not going to be a job. Hemp is the best thing to grow. We've tried it. We've done it. We've had no THC. Nobody's smoking it. But it was like right over their head. And it's like you work 2 years to fight to get the position. And then you're in that position for 2 years learning about things and protecting your personal name and signing things that might actually do good. And then you're out. And then the next person comes in. And then you got to educate them. And it's like a cycle of kissing ass, or what'd you say, grabbing ass with these groups.
And this corruption, like legalized corruption of your brother-in-law has a contract, whatever, I'll tell you how real it is. I was involved with a project very similar to this, but nothing to do directly with biochar, because this was 15 years ago down in Austin. I was consulting on this project. Cool. And it was basically this ecological percolator. And it involved taking a huge portion of the garbage in Austin and taking it to this place instead of the landfill. That was basically the big change that upset people. And the companies that ran the garbage trucks, you're not going to lose any money. You're just going to take garbage to a different place. All of a sudden, we're talking to people with legitimate, like, Brooklyn Italian accents. No, I'm dead serious. Like, this was full on, like, very clear. Like, you're going to get your legs broke, and you're going to come out, and your car's going to have flat tires, and who knows what else is going to happen to you. We're not interested in this. And, like, I'm trying to fix an effing problem, and you've got mafiosos that could have made their mafia money anyway, threatening you and your family and your entire community.
Yeah.
And that, again, that was almost 15 years ago.
Well, it's such a legitimately real thing and concern. And in my opinion, or my perspective, it's you got to be patient, and you got to be patient. You got to be nice. You attract more bees with honey, as they say.
I think what we're doing, and I don't think I'm that important, but what we're doing and getting other people to do it is the biggest part of the solution. The more awareness, one thing the government and these entities do is respond to markets, right? And the people are the market. So the people really are in control, but they're too dumb to know that they're in control. So you have to teach them what to be in control of, is the way of putting it. And I liken this to something I just covered this week. I don't know if you saw the new Super Bowl commercial from Budweiser with the horse and the eagle.
Yeah.
Did you see that? Okay. And I had a lot of people when I shared that said, you know, I still don't trust them. I don't give a shit about them. What I'm telling you is this means the market has changed. The public perception of what people want has changed, because no matter how corrupt these entities are, they know where their bread gets buttered, and they don't want the butter taken away or the bread taken away. So they have to serve the marketplace. And so that commercial, full on, like, feel good Americana, like 1975 Americana, is because that's what people are asking for. So the solution everywhere is the same thing. Get enough people demanding something, and they'll give it to them just to, you know, quote unquote, shut them up.
Yeah.
And so if we can use that power for good instead of evil for once, instead of selling Cabbage Patch dolls, actually grow some cabbage and make some cabbage at the same time, we might be in a better position.
I think, you know, I've had some really, it's been very, this year has been a mission, like getting this all squared away, but it's the conversations and the people, like conversation we're having and others that are pursuing regenerative ag and the, you know, the local food banks and bringing food close, because food is going to, it's, you know it as well as I do. It's if you're in an urban area and there's no food and you have a family of two babies, like you're going to do anything in your power to get food to your babies. And that's where things are going to get ugly someday. But there's so many people that I've seen through this ecosystem that are pursuing things in a regional perspective with their communities. Community gardens is a great start. It's cost effective. It's feel good. You know, you get the dirt in your hands and that's a good start. And, you know, they're doing the food banks and vertical farming, which is a very cost effective, powerful way to make food. I mean, you can have an acre of an indoor lettuce facility growing 40 acres a day. Right. Yeah. So it's like that it's coming. I just hope that it doesn't blossom because of a national security. I hope that we can kind of learn how to make it make dollars and cents ahead of time. And that's what it has to do. It just can't make sense. Like, this makes sense, but how do we make it make dollars and cents? How do we get the bankers excited and things in that nature? And that just requires effort and kindness. Like, nobody wants to work with a pilot if the people that are running the pilot are assholes, unfortunately, unless you have a badass product. And I think we do, but we try to be nice and do it the right way.
It's hard to conceive of how we get to where my mind goes, which is it is affordable for anybody producing large amounts of waste to have a machine that fully automates the production of biochar out of it. Because that sounds we put a man on the moon in 1969. I think we can figure that out. But when you look at the cost of machinery that works at this level, I was dumbfounded when I was talking to the guy that did some tree work for me recently about, well, what does it cost to buy a big chipper shredder? Like one you tow behind a truck, like 70 grand. I paid $84,000 for my first house. I have a hard time with a thing that makes big hunks of trees into wood chips costing $70,000. I know I'm old and crotchety and shit, but like, I don't know how we get there, because you have a great machine. I don't know what you paid for it, if you want to share that, but I'm sure it's very expensive and it's very purpose built for certain things. And so somebody that's running, let's say, a chicken farm with layers has lots of material that they come in, they have to pay to get rid of. It can be made into biochar that can be put in a series of water runoff deposition traps that would do a lot of good and save the money long term. But what does that machine cost? And that machine's probably different than your machine. And it's probably different than the machine that would need to go to somewhere where they're doing cutoffs from cabinetry. And like, there's all these sources, because I make a lot of biochar, but it's time consuming as shit when you're doing it small scale. Like, to do it industrial scale requires industrial equipment. And I don't know that there's enough horsepower and economy of scale going into that yet to start driving down those costs. And I think right now manufacturers want to drive them up.
Yeah. Yeah. Like our machine was about $970,000. So, you know, $1 million. And it's now there's another machine out there that's, you know, $200,000 less. But really, and there's another machine that's about, you know, 500,000, but it's not like designed to output biochar. And, physics and chemistry is trying to push back and say that in a 12 by 37 by 12 shoebox, everybody's pitching, 90% reduction of wood. So if I put 10 tons of wood in, I get 1 ton of biochar out.
Yeah.
How do we get it to a 70% reduction? How do we get more wood? How do we get more char out of the same amount of wood?
Same amount of material, yeah.
So that's in the shoebox. But if you have an enclosed chamber pyrolysis machine, you might be able to get that conversion rate to 30 to 40%, but your CapEx is greater. And then you got the permitting challenges. Like my machine, I don't need permits. Thank God. But if you have a stationary machine, there's actually a company in South Texas, bless their hearts. They spent 2.3 in CapEx. They got the machinery, the pyrolysis, it's stationary. The county comes up and they're like, hey, you're in a flood zone. You got to lift everything up 4 feet. So they built a wall around the entire thing. And they're like, no, the machinery has to go up 4 feet. Flood zone in Texas. So that's some of the challenges as well. It's just like, the local politics behind these things. Like we're on a job site now and we got to get, the silt fence permits today and they haven't been out here yet. And then we got to get water installed and then we can start like clearing. Cause and they're in a time crunch. They need to, there's 30 acres here and each acre we're expecting to have 600 tons of wood. So that's 18,000 tons of biomass that they would typically burn. And so we're going to try to eat through as much of that as we can. And this is our first time doing it. So we're going to see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. What would we do without government? Without government, we might have a better world in a lot of ways. And I think it's like, it's going to sound like a weird analogy, but it's the same reason that the average Major League Baseball pitcher can't bat worth a fuck. They're not paid to.
Right.
That's why. They're worth too much money as a pitcher. They're paid to throw balls, not hit balls.
Yeah.
Right? When they do have to bat, they're take a couple pitches, make the other pitcher use his arm, then lay down a bunt, and if you get on base, great. If you don't, we don't care. Take your $60 million arm back in the bullpen and get warmed up. Like,
yeah.
They're not paid. So the reason bureaucrats can't think is they're not fucking paid to think. They're paid to follow a form, tick off a box, and do what they're told. And I don't care. And I've met some good ones that will break that mold, but they're always young. They're always super young and think they can fight the system. And you got to harness them when they're young and get a new one before they wear out. Right.
Yeah.
Or they're super fucking old and just are common sense old men. And we're losing them. Right. Because they're retiring now, but they don't give a fuck. They're like, well, they told me I'm supposed to do this, but I don't see nothing wrong here. Now I'm going to ask you that question again. When you said no, you meant yes, didn't you? Yeah. Okay, good. You're good. But you get a few of those, but most of them, they're just automatons. They don't think.
Yeah. I've had some stories, we submitted this hemp grant and 6 years of work doing this. I wrote a 170-page documentation about the economy, the relationships, the technology we're going to bring in. And we went to Tallahassee last March, and this is right after Doge. And the guy up there, he's the third longest employee of the USDA. I thought he was going to have a stroke at the table. My team went from 100 down to 2. We have not looked at your paper. And then EPA wrote a $19 million community change grant. That took a year. They didn't even review the grant, even though we're in the final 15 out of 1,200 applicants. And then it's like we finally get blessings from the state's Department of Ag. And she encouraged me to reach out to somebody. And I call him and he's a bureaucrat. He's got a cushion job. He's driving a taxpayer dollar truck.
Yeah.
And just goes around the state checking off his boxes. Like innovation is not in the job description. It's more like, how do I cover my ass and get paid, which is fair, but in the 6 years of me really trying to bring anything in, the economy, the displacement, the community, it's only gotten worse. So last year we just said, you know, YOLO, let's put it all on our own credit and let's put our own money down. And I'm privileged to have a lot of good guys on my team that are willing to, you know, deal with me and my passion and you know, excitement and try to, you know, spur this mission forward. But it's a challenge, but, you know, every challenge is an opportunity to grow, they say. So we're excited to be here.
Yeah. What about misconceptions? And I'm betting, like me, you've had to correct misconceptions to the negative and to the positive, both.
I think, you know, when I, the example of me literally buying a bag and dumping it on the ground thinking it was soil, it's not soil. that's a big one. And, you know, we haven't had too many of those. It's just the, it's the cost to make it. It's expensive right now because of, you know, scalability and being, you know, the guinea pig for the machine is down. The mechanics for the machinery company, they've never seen the machine. So it's like, all right, we have a hydraulic hose that blew and it takes, you know, a week or two to get it back up and running. So our cost of goods sold is pretty high. I think most of the misconceptions are on the ability to make the material versus what the material can do. As long as you take the time to review a few white papers or ask ChatGPT, hey, this is my soil characteristics, this is the biochar, what do you recommend? Because, you know, most of the time it'll say 5 to 20%. You don't want to overload it. And then the I think a big misconception is, will it harm if it pulls, if you put it in the lake and then you take it out of the lake and you put it in the soil, is my kid going to be touching, like, you know, shit bacteria and things of that nature? So we with a lot of the, like, South Florida municipalities, that was a big hesitation for them. And those are a few that we've come across recently, but I'm sure something will come to mind where I'm just like, no, that's completely, you know, tomfoolery.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I've constantly had to push back on is, yes, this was an ingredient in Terra Preta. No, mixing compost and biochar together does not by itself equal Terra Preta. We don't really know all the things that went into that soil, and we can't because of how long ago it was created. And some of the things we do know that goes in there, we generally don't have access to. Like, one of the things they found out is these turtles, they call them terrapins, that they ate the shit out of these things. And like all of the shell and all of that was carbonized. And also some of it was more made into more like potash.
Yeah.
Because they needed to lime those soils. And that was one of the few sources they had. So we don't just, actually, I know where we can get a lot of turtles, but people get mad when I suggest it, but. Every neighborhood park in America is pretty much needs to be thinned out of turtles once a year, but we're probably not going to make, you know, potash out of them or anything like that. But we don't really know exactly, like, there's microbes in there that are indigenous to there and some remote areas in Africa only. And that creates a kind of land, but that also tells us something about the biome. And these people were using this to keep their own waste from stinking. So they were part of them and what they were eating there for. So we can't say it's the same, but we can say it's a good framework to work off of. But there is this almost like a small portion of people who just hate it. And then there's a small portion of people that overly love it and think, if I just sprinkle it with biochar, it's like fairy dust or something. And I've had it like, it does a lot of good and it almost sounds too good. So we don't need to make it sound better than it is, I guess, because the worst thing in the world is to give somebody something that they paid a lot of money for that gives them 85% of what you promised. Mm-hmm. Because no matter how good the 85 is, they only focus on the 15 they didn't get.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's a great, great example. I wish if I can do, like I said, if I can go back and start with a smaller machine and do my own trials, I wish I, because, you know, now that we're full gear, I'm, you know, trying to unload the truck today. It's like there's a lot of things that go on that kind of deflect what I can do as one person. And fortunately, you know, with universities, they're really good to work with, especially because every university in Florida is touching biochar in some capacity. You know, they're trying to do the PFAS removal. They're working with living concrete in South Florida, soil, University of Florida. There's a lot that goes into that, but it's like, for me, I got so much carbon in my socks right now that it's everywhere. And I try to use it. I mean, I use charcoal toothpaste and charcoal soap and just trying to see what's available in this market, because, you know, it could be kind of like hemp. It could be an additive for most of the things that we're using today. Like Polestar is using it in their plastics and their electric vehicles. You know, so in order to make that type of quality, you have to get more equipment, you know.
Yeah.
You can, like this stuff, this is pretty much graphene, and in order to make graphene is stronger than steel.
Yeah.
Now this is like a $100 bottle of it. But how do you make that technology? How do you make it scalable? And there's a lot of misconceptions.
There's things we can do with it, but we can't do it repeatedly. That would be, you know, the next $1 trillion company if somebody skinned it, like supercapacitors. A supercapacitor is basically a super lightweight battery that lasts for, you know, 100 days before you got to recharge it. And we can make one, but we can't make 1,000. We make 1,000 and one, it's kind of like, I've talked about with microchips before and the silicon chips and all. People think, well, like you just make a factory, you start spitting out chips. No, it's like making chocolate chip cookies. Even if you put the same amount of chips in each one, they all bake a little different. So
When
the chips come out, they have to test them, and only like 10% of the chips are actually using the highest level technology. And then there's like a mid grade and a bottom grade. When we do supercapacitors out of this stuff, it's more like 0.1% actually works, and they don't know how to make it work. And there's 100 other, like this is a genie's lamp that just keeps finding new chambers, but it's making it work and making it economically viable. You know, it reminds me of so many of the things. Well, you know, they did this thing and they stuck it in a petri dish and they killed cancer cells. Yeah. But when the person with cancer takes it or injects it, it doesn't do anything. Like, you got to find, how do I get this reaction in this space out of a way that it can be done? And there's a lot of challenge. But that, to me, again, back to what we opened up. The entrepreneur says that's an opportunity, right? And probably you and I are not going to pursue the supercapacitor opportunity. That's billionaires' territory. But we can all kind of break a piece off and do something with, you know, our risk tolerance, our time left in service, all of that. On that, what do you think that maybe somebody listening, if they want to take one practical step toward land restoration, self-reliance after this episode, what would you suggest they start with?
Be super practical, like really hone in on that challenge. And if you're trying to get into biochar, what's your feedstock? What's your closest source of feedstock? Who owns it? Is it a problem there? And then if you can make the biochar, where are they located? And what differentiates you from their current product? And most of the time, the logistical aspect is a no brainer. Start practical, you know, like I'm a dreamer. I risk it for the biscuit. But if I could go back, you know, I'd probably still have a tiger cat today, but you know, March through August would have been a lot less. It's hot outside in Florida too. So, you know, we're running around a 2000 degree machine and it's 100 degrees outside. That was a pretty interesting scenario. And then on the graphene side, though, I did want to mention, like, the big piece of that is if you have 100 tons of wood, you'll have 10 tons of biochar and you'll have 1 ton of graphene. So you got to be able to acquire that wood, hopefully get paid to acquire the wood to then make the graphene. Cause you got, and you know, if you're trying to get into this, you got to find, it's like anything else. One MVP, minimum viable product, is critical, but what other products or services or revenue streams can you take advantage of that solves a problem in that community or that region. But every community can do this. Anybody with, you know, the will to do it can do this. And even if you start in your backyard and play around in your soils, like, it's an exceptional part of a solution for regeneration that we're probably at like 3 to 5% of the market, where it could be, in my opinion, if not less.
Yeah.
So I encourage anybody to start getting invested into it, because the graphenes, the plastics, you know, it's all going to come around very soon. And, you know, I'm hoping that these types of conversations, we can look back in 3 years and see where are we going. Yeah.
I mean, we even have people already doing things to make self-healing concrete with it.
Right? Yep.
EMI shielding. Like, one that kind of came by accident. This lady that was doing like a sustainable build, like, built one room of this house with it in the whatever they call that shit you put on. I want to say spackle, but it ain't spackle. Whatever the stuff you rub on the outside. We don't build houses with it here because they mold. But she, when she went in there, her cell phone wouldn't work. Right. And it's like, wait a minute. So the one variable is that they're in the goddamn, what is that? Stucco. That's it.
Stucco.
You're right. Yeah. In the stucco, she had included a crushed biochar. We have companies that are literally doing mining, creating waste, taking the biochar from the waste and using it to build roads back into the mines. Like, there's stuff going on all over the world that people just don't know about yet.
The market's not even, you know, yeah. On the concrete side, University of Miami, they did something with biochar. 5% additive of biochar increases the strength and porosity 25%. 5% increases 25% and reduces the carbon emission cycle 52%. 5% additive, you know. So you're spot on there. It can go all over.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to commend you. You've done a really great job. You came on the show. You have a company, and you've talked a hell of a lot more about the thing than what you do. And I always appreciate that, because I don't want to turn this podcast into an infomercial. But can you tell? I do want people to also know what you do. Talk a little bit more about what does your company actually do? Who do you work with? What's it like to work with you? How can people get in touch with you to work with you? That type of thing.
Yeah, thank you for that, this opportunity. So I'm with Biotech Applied Research. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We're the first in the nation to acquire 100 tons worth of heavy equipment to convert inactive wood waste into biochar. Yeah, this is our website. Thank you for pulling this up. We're not trying to sell a product. We're trying to provide a product with a service and a solution to your personal problem. So, you know, if you're a municipality, if you're a homeowner that has, you know, soil problems, if you have a lake in your community that needs to be revitalized, like, we can do grants, we can do like offtake agreements, we can help you develop your own process. So we try to keep, you know, life's too short to live unhappy. So we try to make it a fun thing. And we have our operations team is full of a bunch of, you know, hardworking redneck entrepreneurs in Central Florida. And we do have a science department. We have a quality control department. We have a finance department. So, this is the group.
Very, very cool, man. Very cool. And you guys kind of are in that middle Florida region as far as your operations. And I think that's a good thing, because it tells people, like, there's a lot of room. There's a lot. You'll run out of opportunity with biochar when we fix all the problems and when we stop having waste that can be turned into biochar. Right? I mean, your great-grandchildren have job security if you can skin this, is what I'm saying. Like, it's not something we're going to get to. Anybody's like, we're going to have no jobs left. When we don't have any problems, we won't have any jobs. And when we don't have any problems, we won't need any jobs. So I'm not worried about that either. Like, that's how this works. As long as there's a problem, somebody will pay to have it fixed.
Yeah. Like, some people see problems. What's the curve? It's like problems, challenges, opportunities, and blessings, right? It's all the same thing. It's just how you look at it. And we've had conversations with the Argentinian government. We had Deloitte Japan fly in. Like, it's a everybody has the same problems. Like, we're never going to run out of wood waste. And if we do, we're never going to run out of, you know, poop that we can also use for biochar. Like, it's the technology that can convert any waste, even tires. You know, we can turn the tires into a plastic for landfill covering. You know, any waste can be utilized, and everybody has waste. I got waste in my truck, you know, like there's waste everywhere. So how do we turn waste into renewal, or waste into revenue, or trash into treasure? You know, that's
huge waste stream that no one's figured out what to do with yet, that whoever does is going to be a millionaire. Wind machine blades. They're made out of fiberglass. They run about 10 years. They have to be replaced for whatever reason. And it's fiberglass, and it just, there's nobody that they bury them. They dig giant graveyards, throw them in the ground. Like, and if you've ever worked with fiberglass, you get it. Yeah. You get it. I understand. Everything with a broken piece of fiberglass, everything's bad. Everything hurts.
Fortunately, we don't have those around these parts, but I'm sure if somebody comes to my team with that opportunity, I'm sure my very privileged to have some innovative guys that
giant canoes or something. I don't know.
Right, that's a good idea.
you can't put it together. The problem is you can't break it up and put it back together as something else. That's in any way that is remotely economically viable. The good news is if it's organic, as he said, you can turn it into biochar.
I'd love to do this again. I mean, maybe by next year we actually have this project, the circular nutrient economy with the data and the reporting. Yeah. We'd have to, we got to let people know about these things, so people don't have to go through the costs that we have had to go through mentally, physically, economically. But it's going to happen. So it's, you know, appreciate you allowing, I enjoyed this conversation. You're farther ahead than me when it comes to a lot of these applications.
Yeah. Let's do some Q&A real quick. I got about 5 questions and then I'll cut you loose. Before we do that, though, I did want to show people, this is the machine that you guys use. I looked it up when I asked you about it. So you can see, for those on the video anyway, this is a pretty sizable piece of $1 million piece of equipment. And if you want to see that and you're on the audio, like 95% of the people listening to this show, the video, you want to jump to about 1 hour and 30 minutes in to see that machine again. It's called the Tiger Cat 6040. Looks like it beats the shit out of my Weber kettle grill and my saddle cone kiln made out of a 55-gallon drum. There it is in the distance working with an excavator. That's really cool. That's really cool. Again, we're about 1 hour 30, 1 hour 32 minutes in if you want to take a look at some of the stuff and you're otherwise listening. All right, so a question from Bruce says, how much biochar by volume should be combined with compost material at the beginning of decomposition, biochar or volume of biochar for a 4-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot bioreactor? So that's more percentage answer, isn't it?
I love this question because it's like, here's your control.
Yeah.
And if you mix compost with biochar, you're like right here.
Yeah.
But if you mix the biochar while it's composting, you're like up here. You're capturing the ammonium, you're capturing the nitrate, you're increasing your cure time. So we actually, it's funny, we just found out yesterday that we did and it depends on the compost, right? Like the compost that we're partnering with this company with, there was 60% sludge, 30% compost, 10% biochar, and the ammonium was not as good as we expected it. So we're going to bump it up to 15%. So I would say, starting with 20%, you're just spending biochar costs more, a lot more than compost. So you want to get that price point thing figured out. But you know, if you're doing a small batch, I would do 20%. But no higher. Like, treat it like salt.
All I can say is what I do. So once a year, I wreck out my duck coop. It's a 12 by 16 building. It usually ends up about 2 foot deep in deep litter. So I only pull it out once a year. They usually makes 3 bioreactors. Those bioreactors are round. They're 4 foot tall. They're almost full when they're done. And I make about 3 of them in a 5 foot diameter. Right. So it's about 2.5 yards per bioreactor of beginning material. When I clean that out, I put 2 buckets of biochar on the bare floor and I put down about 3 bales of straw. And every so often I either bring a couple of wheelbarrows of wood chips or a couple more bales of straw in there. And if I have it, which I usually do, I put down a 5-gallon bucket of biochar every time I put a new layer. So I'm probably in that 15 to 20% range with it. And when I started doing that about 2.5 years ago, as good as my compost was, it was an exponential and almost immediate improvement in the gardens, down to things like all of a sudden we would get a frost, get 28, 29 degree weather overnight for a few hours. And usually that meant that all the peppers, tomatoes, everything died, and more than half of them were living through that mild frost. And I knew what changed, but I didn't know what biologically changed. And I spoke to Alan Booker last year about that. And he's like, when you do Brix readings on the sap in your plants now, what do you get? And I'm like, somewhere between 10 and 14. And he goes, the plant, the leaf, not the fruit. I'm like, yeah. He goes, that's fantastic. He said, what you're getting there, you're getting enough sugar in the plant's sap that it's effectively acting like an antifreeze.
Wow.
And I'm like, holy shit. And I'm like, but that is as much better as things got until I added the biochar and the bioreactive compost. That didn't happen. That was that final piece that just pushed it over. And I'm not saying everything survives that. I'm saying a lot of plants that should be dead are not.
Yeah.
And it's not a microclimate thing, because they always died in that spot before and now they don't. And that to me is pretty amazing at what it can do. Let's take another one. This one from Fred. Are you saying I think this is for you, and I didn't get any clarification on it, which I asked for. Are you saying your parents want you to have a backup plan for the biochar business?
Parents
always want a backup plan for everything a kid does.
All my dad has ever asked for me is to get a job working for somebody, like, because he's worked for the best citrus growers. You know, when he was my age, they were flying helicopters, buying land, planting orange groves.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's badass. You know, unfortunately, there's not many. There are innovative companies out there in like sustainability and ecosystem restoration, but they're very limited. They want me to have a backup plan for sure. It's when we started and before we got the funding and before I can get like my team to fully commit to this, my ultimatum was I have a job in Thailand at a biochar facility. I'm going to be working a forklift, making, you know, I might get paid to eat for free there or something, but I'm doing it. So like, my ultimatums are pretty dramatic. I'm a dramatic dude, which is why we got all this equipment. So I read that at first and it's like, are you saying that your parents are going to like let you sleep? Like, do you live with your parents? I don't live with my parents, but.
No. And I think parents are like that. And your backup plan is that you know how to build a company. So if it ends up that this is not the space to build a company and you can go build a company in something easier, it'll be like a cakewalk.
Oh man, yeah.
I mean, honestly, like building a company isn't easy, and knowing how to build a business is a backup plan, because I can ask for a job or I can just build a business. Those are very different worlds that exist in. Surf Claude says, "Can we get a version of biochar from a local company?" I guess is what he's saying. They claim their charcoal product salvaged from coal-fired power plant. Is this legit or full of potential problems? That sounds like bullshit to me. That is not biochar. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. Then we moved to Pennsylvania. My whole family's coal miners. Coal mines are bad. I would have to know more to know, because that's so bullshit. that I wonder if it's misunderstood bullshit, but coal to me is zinc. Coal to me is sulfur. Coal to me is acid. Like, everything is bad. Coal ash is terrible. And I don't know if maybe they got some sort of paperwork that lets them call it something it isn't, but I wouldn't fucking touch it personally without knowing more anyway.
So I think they call it coke, right?
Yeah, that's bad shit, man. That's in the Allentown song by Billy Joel. That's how old coke is. Iron and coke, chromium steel, man. Like, all I know is I know of ash piles in Pennsylvania that are still sitting where they were when I was a kid, and everybody's fighting over whose responsibility is, and nobody wants it because it's so toxic. So I don't know what that is, but I'm going to say, unless you can get me some more information, my advice is just don't. And I've never heard of using – it's a different type of carbon. It's formed differently. It does not have pores in it. It doesn't do any. I've never seen coal improve an ecosystem. I've seen it ruin a lot of them. That's all I can say. UUE88. What about the pit method? It's promoted by Pacific Biochar. It's a free method, great for starting farms. So what they're talking about, before you answer this for people that maybe don't know, is you dig a big pit, you throw a bunch of wood in it. Dry, you light it from the top, you let it burn down, you put it out, and you scoop it out of the pit, and you got charcoal. And that is like the oldest method of charcoal manufacture in the world. And it has good and bad, and I'll let you kind of take it from there.
Yeah, and all these questions, like, we'd love for people to reach out on our website and, you know, grow@biotechappliedresearch.org or z.far@biotechappliedresearch.org. Like, these are what we love. Like, my scientist, Joe, like, he's the scientist, so he would be able to, you know, explain it scientifically. Where I call him my quality control president, because he keeps my statements quality controlled, you know. But like pit methods, you can do it. It's just manually intensive, you know, shoveling sand on it to take it out, and you get a lot of ash. But by far the cheapest way to do it. Yeah, I think it's a great method. You're just not going to get a high quality. It's great for farming. I would say yes. Yep.
It's a broad acre technique. It's also like a solution to a problem technique. And here's an example. We did this year. We're 142, if you want to see it and you're on the audio and you want to look it up. This is my backyard. It's near one of my gardens. And I cut a bunch of privet down there this spring. And let it go longer than I should have, and it dried out, and then all the grass grew up through it, and it was in a place where it would potentially set the neighbor's yard on fire when we burned it. So we got the garden hoses out, and me and a couple friends drank some beer and burned it and controlled it. And we did a light from one side top-down burn, and when it was done, all we did was spread it out, wet it down. We didn't crush it. We didn't do anything, and we walked away from it. This is 2 months later.
Wow.
Now, naked char, as you said, is a sponge, and it will take up nutrient. And generally, you want to do something to inoculate and get it ready, like put it in compost ware. The area here has so much duck shit on it from so many years. There was plenty there to take up. But you can see that's just the same grass. And for those that are not seeing it, what you have is it looks like a mound. There's no mound there. That's just how much more and how dark it is. That's just the outline of where the pile was. And so it does work. The key is when you're using the right equipment, you're crushing the size, you're inoculating, the response is better. And the duration of the response, everything is better. But if you have a shitload of waste to get rid of, there's worse things than piling it up, doing controlled burns, putting it out before it turns to ash, and spreading it out. And if your choice is to do that or to burn it to ash or pay somebody to take it away, especially if that person ain't going to make biochar out of it, you're probably better off doing a top burn. I mean, that is, for all of the romance around Terra Preta, it is how they made it.
Yeah.
It's pit burning. The difference was they did it for 100 generations. And we're trying to get there quicker because, well, we fuck shit up a lot more. Right? We're at like the peak of productivity of a civilization, but the valley of value, right? We're making more stuff than ever, but with the lowest value of output in the history of civilization that we know of anyway. Maybe the Atlanteans fucked it up and that's where they really went. Who knows? But as far as we know, I don't know that we've ever had a time with more stuff and shittier quality in the existence of humanity.
That'd be a tough argument, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just think of like being a kid, a teenager, and being in my grandpa's workshop and pulling out a hatchet made by Craftsman in the 1890s. And the fact that wherever that tool is today, if somebody didn't throw it away, it probably still works.
Still there, yeah.
All right, and that's 130 years now, and that tool is a better quality than I can go out and spend $300 on a hatchet, and it won't be better than that.
Yeah.
You know, the Mitchell 300 fishing reels I have from 1966 still work today.
Still work.
You think a 2026 Daiwa is going to work in you know, the year 2096? Get the fuck out of here. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. And we all know it's not going to happen, right? Now, we could restore that, but we're just not there yet. And so that's where I think the high cost of this biochar equipment is. We're starting something brand new, and it's not commoditized yet. So it's not yet a race to the bottom. Now it's a race to the best quality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that society's not used to. We haven't done that for a while, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm all for any way you want to make it is better than not making it.
Right.
You know?
It's fun. It's, I mean, like, I got 5 tons at my house that I just, like, when I got food, I throw it in there. You know, I'll take some out and I'll throw it around my plants. It's, you'd be surprised what a little bit can do in some areas. It's just, if you can make it yourself, like what you've been doing, it's you know, what do you, DIY project, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's tons of ways too. Like, if you're a suburban person and you're just using all your trimmings and shit and you're going to make, you know, a half a yard a year at the most, maybe you're going to pick up some stuff that your neighbors put out, you can make it a Weber kettle grill.
Yeah.
And it actually makes more than you'd think. Like the first crush, it makes 2 5-gallon buckets of biochar because it's continuous add. So when you, if you make something like a retort and you have a 30-gallon drum inside a 50-gallon drum, you fill the 30-gallon drum and there's a lot of airspace in there. And so that volume's already lost. And then when it becomes charcoal, there's a surprisingly small amount left because you start with your maximum volume and then crush down. Where with any of the continuous add systems like Kelpie Wilson's Ring of Fire, just an open drum burn, a kettle grill, a Contiki cone, any of that shit, you're constantly adding. So when you're done, you can literally be full. And a 55-gallon drum on its side with a saddle cut in it, I don't know the right term for it, but that's what I call it. That makes a shitload. And here's the thing. If you have the material, running 4 of them isn't much more work than running 1.
Right.
You just kind of throw some wood and keep an eye on it and know when to add more. So it's a great way to drink some beer, tell some stories to your grandkids, and make biochar. You know, and you get a pretty good crush just from the quench in those systems because when it gets hit with water, it kind of shatters. And I don't know what size. You guys probably crushed a really, really fine size. You got a piece of equipment to do it. But if it goes through a quarter-inch screen, I call it good.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
after that's the third time I ran over it, if it doesn't, fuck it, it's going anyway. I put it in with the ducks and let them eat it and shit it out. It'll all take care of itself in time.
You know, with speaking about animal feed, I think it reduces methane out of cow shit like 50%.
Yeah, something. Yeah.
So like, you know, back, you know, a couple years ago when somebody else was running the country and everybody's thinking cows are causing global warming, it's like this could have been a great solution to that. But in Texas,
I don't want a solution. Yeah. I want Marxism.
Yeah. There's a story behind that, which is
yeah. I know that works from anecdotal evidence as well, because usually by mid-April, when I go out to my duck house in the past, it's swarming with flies. And when I go out there, since I started, I'm not going to say there's no flies in a duck coop. That's just not going to happen. But it's a handful. I used to hang up those strips. I'd hang up one in the morning and replace it in the evening, and the flies were landing on other flies and not getting stuck anymore.
Right.
And now I can put a strip out there and it lasts 3 weeks.
Because of the, you know, the, because it sucks, it takes the smell away.
It takes the smell, so that attracts less. But it all, I think it's actually sucking the, because duck shit is very liquid, and I think it's sucking it in, and it's making it not accessible to them. Because what they're doing in that, in the straw holds it, and then they're literally laying their eggs on that shit, and those maggots are eating the shit out of the straw. But when, I think when it's in biochar, they're not able to get at it sufficiently to reproduce at the same kind of level, you know, because 1,000 flies turns into 1,000,000 flies really fast. And 1,000 is not a big stretch in the spring in a coop, you know. All right, we got one more from Hippocrates Garden. I like that name. What volume could you make if appropriate feedstock were available at unlimited quantity? I guess unlimited output. My wooded land, it has slowed me down in a good way. No tree comes down I can't process in some way. That seems disconnected as a question, but what, I mean, I guess the production limit, if the supply is unlimited, would only be based on the size of the equipment and how much of it you had, really. I mean,
we got to bring in the bureaucratic part of it too, you know. In Cali, these machines are running 24/7. And where I'm at now on this site, I can burn from 9 to 5 and, you know, 20 tons an hour. So, you know, that's, what is that? 1,000, 200 tons a day is until I can, you know, do what I'm good at and get to Tallahassee and make it 24/7.
I'm answering somebody that needs to be smacked out once in a while. What do you think it does? He's always got an idea that somebody else needs to do. Sometimes they're good, but sometimes they're just annoying. I said good things about you, Jake. Don't ruin it now. Anyway, man, I really appreciate you. Again, your website. Tell people about your website, how they can get in touch with you and where you operate out of.
Yeah, Jack, you have a great way of articulating things and making it good for your audience. So I appreciate the time. And I got to say thank you to Tony Elliott, who's a huge fan of yours, who really encouraged for me to fill out the application. So thank you for all that. Thank you, Tony. And biotechappliedresearch.org, one word, is the website. z.far@biotechappliedresearch.org is my email. And my cell phone is on the website as well. You can shoot me a text. And that's probably the best way to reach us. We're very appreciative of looking at your comments. The next time you're in Florida, man, hit me up. I'd love to go fishing in the Everglades or something.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. And I need to get some fishing done further north of where I usually go anyway. Of course, we're getting strafed by the F-35s here at the end, but at least it's at the end. Appreciate you being with us today, Zach. I'm going to make sure a link to your website and to where you got your machine from are in the show notes. If you'd like me to add anything else, just pop me an email. It takes me about an hour to get everything up on the audio side, so plenty of time to get it over to me, and we'll add anything else you want me to add. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you for the work that you guys are doing and for making the investment of your time, your talent, and your money into something that really matters.
Thank you. And back to you. Thanks for all you do. Hopefully the show number 4,500, we can hop on again. And
yeah, something like that.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. We are going to cross next week. We'll cross 3,800.
That's crazy. That's awesome.
That's a lot of podcasts. Anyway, man, take care.
Take care, buddy. Thank you.
All right, folks, real quick, let me wrap up for you. That was a great interview. It is a challenging space, biochar. But it is in some ways to me like a moonshot. Like when Kennedy said we were going to go to the moon by the end of a decade, it sounded ostentatious and ridiculous. But it had a lot of benefit beyond just the fact that it was done. This might actually have a much bigger benefit because it's more tangible. I mean, whether or not somebody's on the moon doesn't really affect your life, but the quality of the food you eat, the quality of the water that you drink, and the resiliency of your community are way more important than a man on the moon or not, you know. And this is the kind of thing that we have to come at it from a lot of different angles to make it work. We really do. And it's also one of those things, like, you can have a multi-million dollar machine doing this. You can have a billion-dollar company doing this. And a dude with an old barrel that you can buy for $15 or a Weber kettle grill that you can buy for $15 in Facebook Marketplace or maybe get for free can still do it. There's not a lot of things that span that breadth of opportunity of entry. And it also can be a monetary component, not just at the larger level that we talked about today, but small scale homesteading. There's a lot of potential. You know, if you sell biochar, you're probably not going to do that great. But if you make compost with biochar in it and you sell that, you can probably sell it at a premium, especially if you teach people that, hey, a 1 gallon bag of my biochar infused compost used as an extract can do more for your garden than a 50 pound sack of compost from Home Depot or Lowe's could ever even dream of doing, or honestly, a truckload from a compost facility can ever do. So you have to think about how these pieces and parts fit together in your model, not just in other people's models. So what I'm saying is a lot of times when we talk about bigger technology, we're speaking in a hypothetical, what if, wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it be great if we could? And here we're coming from a point of, but you can if you want to. So I encourage you to learn more and give it a shot. If nothing else, you'll roast some hot dogs and marshmallows and have fun with your kids. And you'll end up with ash instead of biochar. And you'll be angry for 5 seconds, but you'll be happy for a couple hours. That's a good exchange. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and remind you guys some ways you can help support this show. One is to buy my book, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by me, myself, and I, Jack Spierko. The book has done incredibly well, better than I could have possibly imagined. That's why Laws of Life 2 will be coming out either late spring, early summer this year. It's pretty much done at this point. I am waiting for the forward to come back, and I got a really cool person writing my forward. I'm not going to tell you who it is, because every time I go out and say somebody before it's done, it always falls apart, so I'm thinking that's bad luck. But it'll be really cool when you find out who's writing the forward for Laws of Life 2. But right now, you can get a copy of Laws of Life 1. Well-reviewed, great feedback. Give it a shot. I think it can help make your life a little bit better by teaching you how to think about problems versus telling you what to do about problems, putting you in control of your own destiny. And if I could name a perfect demographic, everybody, but young people age 15 to 35. I wrote the book with those people in mind because it's what I wish somebody would have told me when I was a young person, 15 to 35, trying to find my place in the world. This book is how I made it happen for myself. Next up today, you can always do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. No matter what you buy there, you'll help us out because we'll get a little kickback for it. It is a time of year to be starting your plants. I'm going to be going full scale, putting seeds in dirt by this weekend. I've got a whole new system set up in the garage. But one of the things that I use are these little 2-inch nursery pots. They fit in a 1020 and they fit very efficiently compared to something round, but they're significantly larger than like your small 72 count or 144 count, six packs. So the plant has more room to work. These pots are actually designed to be used in hydroponic systems and they work great for that. But it also makes some great pots for starting seeds and soil, potting soil, et cetera, as well. And they're multi-purpose. They're also extremely affordable, 120 of them for $20. Mine are now in their fifth season, and I haven't had one crack on me yet. I don't leave them out in the sun over the season or anything like that, but that's plenty of use. I definitely wouldn't call them a single-use product for sure. And I usually get about 2 production cycles per season out of them. So that's like 10 years of use for a lot of people, and they're still just fine. So check them out. And remember, no matter what you buy, you can always help us out by starting at tspaz.com. With that, I'll let you go. And believe it or not, even though we just finally got back from all that time off, we've knocked out the better part of a week already, and tomorrow will be an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Tune in for that because I'm going to have a really interesting segment tomorrow. Of course, that means we will not have a live, we'll not have video. It will be Memorex only. Old people know what that means for you tomorrow. And then Monday we'll be back and we'll do this all again. We are straight shooting pretty much no time off or away all the way out until April when I'll be up in Tennessee for the Living Free in Tennessee workshop with Nicole Sauce. I heard from her this morning. I think she has 6 tickets left. So if you want to come, get your tickets, come up there and meet me and some other really cool people. With that, take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that Expert Counsel show.
They said you should have a house the American way. dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.